This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Yeah, I can't type with my left thumb, so I'm very impressed whenever I see that. Yeah.
What do you do?
I just do the one finger. Yeah.
What?
Wow. Yeah.
Jeez.
Wait a minute.
That is.
Why can't
tough
you
life.
Use your left thumb?
I don't know. It's like a weird shake I have. I don't know.
Oh.
Just coordination.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 Coco. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by Andy Keats. He's the managing editor for special projects investigations here at Voice San Diego. He's also an excellent sort of two-thumb typist on this phone. Hello, Andy.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for that introduction.
Managing editor for Daily News, Andrea Lopez Villafana. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis. I'm
coming
caffeinated.
Up. Good,
sorry.
Let's go.
Interrupted you. I'm super caffeinated.
Let's go. Coming up on the show this week, another signature gathering effort has gone down, almost fully down. A tax for parks and libraries is thus almost dead. The city clerk and registrar say the effort to raise a parcel tax to fund programming and some capital needs at libraries and parks has come up short. We'll explain why we keep doing this, and what the campaign leader said about what happened. We've also got some updates on stories we've been following. And finally, a county supervisor, Tara Lawson-Reamer, talked to Andrea Lopez Villafana here about homelessness, behavioral health, housing, and how she thinks the Board of Supervisors can tackle those issues. That's all coming up. Stay with us. We're going to get into all of that, but first, this week marks the 18th anniversary of Voice of San Diego's launch in the public, 2005, February 9th. This thing comes online and people dealt with it. It was quite a day. If Voice were a person, could smoke cigarettes by now, vote, buy lottery tickets. It's getting up there. But we will keep sticking with what we do. We do investigative journalism, and we also have a new mission. So we have always gone with this sort of elaborate two-part mission, right? This mission mm-hmm. statement that we bring out. On the one hand, it said we do groundbreaking investigative journalism, mm-hmm. and then on the other, we provide the information that people need to be advocates for social progress and good government. We decided that was quite long. Mission statements are always best, just a few words, get something across. And maybe we could try to do that. We ended up having a great conversation with the board and staff and other stakeholders and got into this one simple version. It is investigative journalism for a better San Diego.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Put that on a t-shirt.
Yeah, no, we actually should. Do we have
should.
That as a t-shirt?
We should.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Our t-shirt game has always been lacking.
It's been bad.
Yeah.
If we got some good merch, people would go. People
as
would go
Andy
excited.
Wears a bright orange shirt.
Yeah, it's comfy.
It's not in his color palette.
Devastated over yeah. here.
He's going to cry tonight. So we understand one of your first questions after that might be, well, what's a better San Diego? Well, you can check out actually what we have to say about that because we have, I think we were the first news organization of this type to come up with something like this. basically, it's a longstanding effort we've done to try and identify like what we're doing here. Like, what's the point, right? Where are we coming from? And I've always felt that journalists have not been entirely honest with people when they talk about.
Yeah, they always have the little back door there where it's like when they're pushed to any level of discomfort about why they did a story or why they were compelled to write a story, that they're just putting it out there.
Yeah.
As if they happened upon it at random.
Yeah. So the objectivity, right? I'm an objective journalist, or that piece of journalism, very objective. That's always been like a very high ideal. And in fact, the most praise we get often when people are excited about some stories we've done is that it was a very objective story. And so if you think about objectivity, it's a little bit hard because we're not a mirror. We're not a perfect like reflection of what is happening. We go about trying to decide what to do, what mm-hmm. stories to do, what to care about, what to get fired up about. You've heard us on the show care about things and care about other things less. Those are subjective decisions. We all agree, I think, on this table mm-hmm. that murder is bad. Mm-hmm. I would bet that the objective journalists at KPBS would think that murder, in most cases, is bad. And that like stealing money from like a nonprofit is bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would agree that, you know, dumping sewage into a school playground is bad. Something like that, right? People would be okay with that.
Yeah.
All we wanted to do several years ago is come out with like, okay, well, what values do we carry into these decisions? Because there's obviously some things we're not going to have, you know, yes or no's about. We're not going to have a balanced story about whether murder's good or not. Some people say murder's good. Some people say murder's bad.
You know, I always thought that it was actually sort of, it was probably not a coincidence that we did this when others hadn't. And I think it's because of our size. I think when you're smaller, it becomes much easier to ask and harder to explain why you did one thing versus another.
Yeah.
A large newspaper, which, you know, there are fewer and fewer of them every day, but at least has the outward appearance of covering everything or close to everything, right? It's much less stark when you see a story and you're like, why did they write that? You know, at the 1995 version of the Baltimore Sun, which covered basically everything of it that had crossed any sort of threshold of significance. When we were doing like 5-7 stories a week, it becomes much easier to be like, help me understand why you did this story, as opposed to the dozens and dozens of other stories out there. And so I think as a natural follow-up for that, it became essential to try to put pen to paper about how we make those decisions.
Yeah, just deciding to cover something is itself a subjective decision. So mm-hmm. what are you carrying into that? And so we came up several years ago with a What We Stand For document, had 9 principles of values that we carried into our reporting. If somebody said, what's your bias, what's your agenda, we could point to that and say, well, that's it. That's what we've all agreed to. Anything else is somebody else freelancing, but that's not it. And that also helps us like identify the big problem, right? Mm-hmm. So if we go at something that's like, if the road's falling apart, we have a value that like infrastructure is important, it needs to be strong. If a school is failing to serve its students or having a bad experience there, or it's unsafe, like we can stand on a principle that says like you should have a high quality education.
Even if a reporter is kind of feeling like they don't have their bearings, and they're like, how do I get back on the right path?
Right.
They could pull it up and say, all right, what is it that we're supposed to focus on?
Right. So that has been updated as well. So when you say investigative journalism for a better San Diego, what's a better San Diego? Well, we got the What We Stand For document. You can check it out at vosd.org/values. And I think it's good because we can still be fair and objective about the solutions mm-hmm. that people have for certain problems. If a road's falling apart, well, maybe we should have a Hyperloop instead. Or maybe we should have, you know, if people aren't responding to medical emergencies fast, maybe it's a firefighter that needs to do it, or maybe it's an ambulance or a paramedic working out of a storefront. Those are things.
You've always loved that explanation.
It's a very simple one to go with. So, Lopez, does it give you peace? Are you feeling good about it?
Yeah, I'm feeling super good about it. I say we throw it on a bunch of shirts and I'm ready to
the
share.
The whole What We Stand For document?
No.
That might actually be kind of cool.
That would be crazy.
You
could put it on a tote or the back of a shirt, maybe.
Yeah, back of the shirt. I have a back of a shirt that has the whole First Amendment on the
back.
Oh, that
would be cool.
I've always enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Meg, get to it.
All right.
Waiting in line at a roller coaster, some person behind you could read it.
If you support that
and
mission.
Like basically only in that situation.
Or if they're waiting for their latte and you're just standing there.
Probably not enough time.
Nah, there's like pickup now.
Yeah.
In mobile orders.
It's mostly roller coasters, I think.
You can support that mission and all of the rest of the work we do here at VOSD.org/podpeople. Reference the pod and we'll remember you and highlight that. VOSD.org/podpeople. If you want the What We Stand For document, get that at VOSD.org/values. That's VOSD.org/values. And if you do support us, give $18 maybe, $1,800 we got today from a longtime supporter. $18 for 18 years of nonprofit journalism with a purpose. We appreciate everybody out there. There are a few updates to stories we've been following. A few weeks ago, we had a conversation about High Tech High. This is the, I think, best known network of charter schools in San Diego, innovative project-based learning approach. There's been documentaries about it, prestigious for a long time. We have been following very closely the effort of educators there to unionize, and they did unionize, but then they've been fighting with management for quite some time about a contract. Our Jacob McQuinney reported this week that they have agreed to a contract. And they kind of came to an interesting deal about the most important part of the impasse, which was what it takes to fire a teacher. And so the administration wanted a 3-year probationary period where it was easier to let go of a teacher who wasn't performing well. The union wanted an independent group to decide on an appeal of a firing. Mm-hmm. And they both got what they wanted out of that. So the union got its independent group, but the management got its 3-year period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so just to put that in context for anybody who doesn't have chapter and verse on the union hiring and firing situation at San Diego Unified School District and other public schools in the state, basically most teachers have a 2-year probationary period. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But since layoff notices need to go out in March, it ends up being more like a year and a half or so of when a brand new teacher could actually be displaced from a school.
A principal. You have to act very quickly, in other words, if you see somebody who's not fit for the role.
Right.
Otherwise, it takes a very long and very rare process to let them go.
Yeah. A long and time-consuming enough process that it basically doesn't happen.
Right.
And then when those firings among traditional public schools are appealed, they appeal to a state body.
Mm-hmm. It goes through the courts?
It goes through the courts, eventually. So this is different than that. It's 3 years instead of two, and there is an appeal to a separate independent board, but not the same state system or potential courts.
Which is interesting because it is the same union as the San Diego Unified School District Union, San Diego Education Association is representing. So you have to wonder if we've gotten over the charters versus traditional schools, union versus non-union war, will these...
Which does seem preemptive that we've gotten over.
No, I know. But I mean, I'm just saying, like, obviously that's not the case here because they're unionized.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And so if you've gotten past that... Could there be, as charters were set in motion to be as sort of factories for experimentation of different ways, could there be experimentation in how these relationships work?
In the union contracts themselves? Or
is it just going to be the way it...
Or is it just going to be... Because so High Tech High is certainly among the most notable of the charter school systems here in San Diego County. But some of the other most notable ones have been in the same stream here. Price, and Gompers, both as well. So it's like it's not an isolated situation. There is some, you know, the old rule of journalism: you need three for a trend story. We got three.
Yeah, so Jacob has been tracking that story for a while.
Yeah, he spent time with them as they were, you know, counting votes. And he's been watching this as they've gone through, like, different points in their negotiations, frustrations, right? When they reached a point where they felt like nothing was really going to happen, they weren't going to get their way. But so he was with them when they counted up the votes, and he describes a lot of excitement. They had a big cake there.
Yeah. They didn't know if it was going to be a sad cake or a happy cake.
Happy cake.
Now, I remember this had been a dark time for High Tech High. Like, it was, again, it was the top of the the charter school mountain for a long time. Obama highlighted it as a school of success, and then it got hit really hard with COVID. I think that's a lesser told story, by the way, during COVID, just how much trouble charter schools had to open again. They were very responsive to their community, and a lot of their community members didn't want to see it open. And
and that's sort of an interesting part, because it's one of the issues with charter schools has been, like, they're this proxy in like a very partisan fight over education. Like, conservatives view them as a tool to potentially start breaking down the public school system, or certainly that was a characterization. And liberals often opposed them as something that would undermine the public school system. And yet, like, at a place like High Tech High, most of the parents were liberal, and most of the teachers were there specifically because they were, like, excited by some of the more, like, progressive teaching philosophies that were on display. And so with COVID, you had, like, this partisan fight that was emerging about should schools be open or not. And private schools often offered an outlet for conservative parents who wanted kids to be in school earlier. And public schools were open later, but charter schools were caught back in this situation where it was, like, didn't quite fit on those partisan lines that had been drawn for the education reform debates of the previous decade and a half.
Yeah, and then there were some pretty high profile educator firings there. The principal left. It was pretty dark for a while. So this, hopefully for them, points to a brighter future. In other union news, the Deputy Sheriff's Association is the largest union of officers in San Diego County. They have made a change at their own leadership. Now, this has always been an odd political situation, because the Republicans who decide on their benefits, or used to decide on their benefits, at the County Board of Supervisors level. So these are the sheriffs that work in cities that don't have their own police departments, or in other areas of the county where there's no city, right? So there's these unincorporated areas. So these officers are often very conservative, but there's been leadership at the County Board of Supervisors that for a long time was Republican, and a lot of them didn't want to give them good benefits, right? They would cut back or ask for reform of their benefits going forward. And so they had this weird situation where they would often support for a while they supported Kristen Gaspar, who pushed to get rid of their or lower their pension benefits. And then they later came around and endorsed Nathan Fletcher, a Democrat, who supported their benefits. But now they're not so happy about the liberal agenda. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so they essentially chose new leadership, and not, as has often been the case in, you know, when a union has a Democratic election among their members to change leadership. This was not at the end of a term. This was a change in leadership preemptively that brought in a new group of people. And it wasn't, you know, sort of, unfortunately, when they cast their votes, they don't list the reasons for having done it, that you can draw a direct correlation from one thing to another. But if you listen to past surveys of their membership, some of their issues were with perceptions of politics that break down on culture war lines around the Democratic leadership at the county, and things like the requirements for vaccination at the county that they had.
Yeah, so
which were not that stringent really at all.
Yeah, so David Leonardi and Eric Garcia were president and vice president. They've been replaced by Michael O'Dean and Timothy Richards. And yeah, there was pretty, they wanted different, something different, and it'll be interesting to see, because will they emerge as more of a political force to try to try to serve as that opposition to what the Board of Supervisors has been heading towards. As what are they most frustrated about, though? Like helping homeless people, or
if you go back to like just the most recent election cycle, like they endorsed Nathan Fletcher and also Jim Desmond.
Yeah.
Right. So like you sort of have to ask like what real change politically do they expect to make based on their support? Jim Desmond was a prohibitive favorite to win re-election as a conservative in Inland North County area. And Nathan Fletcher, as a much more liberal guy, was a prohibitive favorite to win re-election in the urban core of San Diego. You could, if you wanted, you could endorse a Republican opponent to Nathan Fletcher if they're more aligned with your interests on policing or on COVID mandates. But is it going to sway the difference in winning or losing? And then what have you done for your relationship with the person who's going to set your benefit standards, right? And same goes for Jim Desmond. You know, I mean, he's probably more aligned with some of the things that I think they motivate them in the first place. But it's like, if these races aren't going to be competitive, are you better set as a union in making a pragmatic choice or setting a hard line on your political beliefs?
So it's still striking to me how important the vaccine discussion became in all of these police union discussions, right? In San Diego, they clearly still don't like the mayor. The police don't care for the mayor in large part because of the very strict COVID vaccine mandate that he put in place. The county very intentionally avoided that sort of mandate. They asked for a testing requirement, and they got it, but
even that was considered too much.
Yeah,
there should have been nothing.
Should have been nothing. So they just did not like COVID being something that the county was worried about.
Yeah, seems like it. and this is not us like hypothesizing. They filled out a membership survey like a year ago that La Prensa published, and they listed these as like top concerns.
For the last several years, we have been talking about how supposedly easy it was going to be to raise taxes in San Diego and across California. Now that groups could put a special tax on a ballot using signatures and not have to get 2/3 of the vote. We've always talked about one of the key facts about why you couldn't build a stadium in San Diego for the Chargers was because, unlike other cities across the country, you need a 2/3 vote for a special tax here. You can get a 50% plus one vote if you just give the government money. But if you say it's going to go to a new trolley line, or it's going to go to a new stadium, or it's going to go to police or whatever, if you say specifically where the money is going to go, it has to have a higher threshold. Now, that seems backwards, right? Because if you're gonna just give the government money, it seems like it should be harder to just
because
give
that's
it.
Less accountability.
Right,
it could be used for whatever.
But right. If you're going to give it money for a specific purpose, then it can be held more accountable. Why would that have a higher threshold? Well, it's because they were trying to stop taxes increases from being passed, so they made it harder for the things that would be easier to pass. And so that was supposed to get changed by the Supreme Court's decision several years ago that you can pass taxes if you get a majority vote of the citizenry, that the part that says 2/3 doesn't impact or isn't inclusive of the citizens' initiatives. Citizens' initiatives just need 50% plus one to become law, and that includes taxes. That was what the Supreme Court decided, and there were then a bunch of efforts after that to do signatures to raise taxes, and they're all struggling in San Diego.
Struggling in San Diego specifically.
In particular. Yes. So there's the only one right now that is surviving, and that is the ongoing effort to prove that the 2020 measure to raise taxes on tourists who come, on the hotel room tax, for an expansion of the convention center and homeless services and roads, that is still going through the courts because the city's saying it really did pass because it only got, it got more than 60% of the vote. It didn't get 2/3, but it was a citizens initiative, even though the city attorney said twice it needed 2/3.
On the ballot.
On the ballot.
Which
seems like
it's still an interesting thing.
Yeah, it seems like a bad coordination going on there.
Yeah.
Whatever. That's
no, I
that's, that was the best.
I often like to try to think of easy ways I could explain things to people who don't pay close attention to politics, and like, yeah, the city as a whole really wanted this to pass on the basis of what was allowed by the Supreme Court, but the city attorney specifically said on the ballot that that was not the case, has always been a hard one to explain.
Yeah, because she kind of just didn't believe that the court was going to rule as it did, right?
So just didn't say that.
Okay, so that's going to take another 500 years to resolve in the courts. So in the meantime, there was an effort to raise signatures to put a tax for San Diego Association of Governments and the transportation and transit plan that it had. And they spent a lot of money, millions of dollars, and it did not make the ballot. Then there was this effort to raise signatures to get a parcel tax on the ballot. So this would be a 2-cent fee for every square foot of land that you own in San Diego. And that would go to libraries and parks within the city of San Diego. Mm-hmm. And they also spent more than $1 million, and they turned in their signatures, and they have found out what a lot of others have found out, which is that they are insufficiently,
they don't have enough
signatures.
Now, they have some like recourses right in front of them. Yes. They can still like sort of try to work out with the registrar, but the official word from the registrar as published on their website is did not have enough signatures, disqualified.
Yeah, the city clerk.
City clerk
put that out there. Say it's insufficient signatures. The registrar of voters is the one that does that validation process. So just quickly, what they do is they take all the signatures. There's 110,000 that were turned in. There's 80,000 that were required. A little more than 80,000 that were required to be valid. They don't want to count all 80,000 to see. So they do a representative 3% sample. And if the sample has an error rate that's high enough, they can tell if the error rate will carry through. And then they say it's not high enough to do the full count. That's what they've done here. Now, there again, like you said, they're arguing there's a few ways that they could get a few more of those signatures validated and make the error rate lower and figure it out. But I think this is disappointing to a lot of people in the parks and libraries world, the kind of upper echelon of people who were trying to help the parks and help the libraries and do more programming. But there was also a lot of things, like pretty exciting things, kind of on tap, like in Skyline, in City Heights, mm-hmm. and in Linda Vista. Over the summer, they had been doing parks after dark engagement things. And they were really lively things where the kids were coming out, they're riding their bikes down to these parks that are at night, not the usually most attractive places. They were engaged, they were active. These are the kinds of things they wanted to put on at those parks. Plus all the, as I've talked about before, you travel around the region, there's just an incredible disparity in how good some parks are and how bad some of them are. And they were going to try to add some of the investment on that, and then the libraries, of course, for more programming. And so all of that is probably lost in this. And
except insofar as the city of San Diego is pursuing a large, much, much larger tax increase.
Well, that's what I found out. I poked around at this at City Hall about, well, aren't you guys disappointed in this? Because you had all these plans. You've got these staffing and programming shortages at all these parks. You're not going to do that. And they're like, well, it's good because Councilman Raul Campillo and Mayor Todd Gloria are apparently working at City Hall right now to generate support for a full cent increase to the city's sales tax to use for all kinds of needs. They won't identify yet what that is. They want to figure that out. But also, they would put it on as a general tax increase on the ballot So it would not be able to say what the money would go for. It would be just for the city of San Diego. But if they put a full cent sales tax increase on the ballot, that's about $300 million more per year going to the city.
And the city already pays for things like park and library improvements out of its general fund.
Right.
And therefore could do that out of the general fund with this extra $300 million per year.
Yeah, I couldn't get anybody to comment officially on what was going on. We'll keep trying to hunt that down. But the city of San Diego has a 7.75% sales tax. Chula Vista now is at 8.75%. So it'd get up there with them. El Cajon, I think, is at 8.25%. But the first thing I thought of was Sandag.
Yeah.
Because they project not one, not two.
LeBron James. Not one, not two.
But three sales tax increases would pass countywide for their transportation plan within the next 7 years.
By 2030.
Yeah. That's so not real.
Yeah. I mean, we're already like a few months past the first one that was supposed to be passed.
Right. So.
Which didn't happen.
If the city jumped up a whole cent.
Yeah, it's stealing the thunder. Yeah.
The cannibalizing.
Capacity cannibalizing, yeah. Sure.
So that seems even less real now, if that's something that the guy who's a big part of Sandag, Todd Gloria, if he wants the tax increase just for San Diego, maybe he's not so on board with what Sandag wants to do.
Yeah, there's a whole body of elected officials called the Sandag Board that like votes for the regional transportation plan that like officially says all of these tax increases that are going to be approved. And this is not just this most recent one, like going back decades. I can't help but think that often people don't support all of those tax increases.
Yeah.
Like the amount of tax increases that are officially required to do all the things that people say they're going to do are not something that I think people actually on that board all support.
Or maybe they didn't read it.
I think they just don't think it's real, so they just don't think it matters.
It's like a Model UN thing?
Yeah, I think it's like a Model UN thing.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
This week, I got together with County Supervisor Tara Lawson-Reamer. In 2020, Lawson-Reamer ousted Republican Kristen Gaspar, which helped Democrats secure a majority on the Board of Supervisors. She serves District 3, which spans from Coronado to Carlsbad. 2 years into her term, I decided to pull her in to talk about the biggest issues the county is facing: homelessness, behavioral health, the service worker shortage affecting those efforts, and a few of the new projects she's excited about. Here's our conversation. If you're a listener to the Voice of San Diego podcast, you know that we often talk about homelessness and how we've been covering it. And I mean, it really is like the top issue that people in this region are concerned about. It's, you know, even become to the point where people in my everyday life, people who are not very involved or, you know, into policy or what's going on with the city, it's the issue that's top of mind, right? It's the thing that's kind of getting them to pay attention and realizing that this crisis is just getting worse. What is the current state of the county's behavioral health options? I mean, there's a lot of things that are coming, but how would you, you know, describe to someone who just wants to understand, like, where are we at as a county with what we have to offer right now?
We have challenges. I mean, honestly, the behavioral health, what goes back to the workforce issue, just an underinvestment in workforce for so long. We're on track right now to have about 18,000 too few behavioral health workers by 2030. And so that's why we as a board are prioritizing investments in behavioral health workforce. We just set aside $15 million to catalyze new growth in people who are becoming qualified to be behavioral health workers. And a lot of these facilities that people need, you know, don't exist. The investment model, and you really can trace it back to, you know, the late 70s, which cut spending on behavioral health, or thought it cut spending, but it's more like it cut spending on preventative care. Mm-hmm. And then you just ended up with people in hospitals. And mm-hmm. So I would say we are moving, but we're on behavioral health, and we're moving at lightning speed. But the challenge, the backlog that we inherited, that honestly, I would say started the year before I was born. So I've inherited a problem that started in 1977. We have a problem that's been 45 years in the making. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that I think we're doing as a board that's so important is tackling this. We obviously have a huge crisis on our hands. And one of the things the data has shown us that's really so distressing is that we are getting folks off the streets. We're actually getting folks off the streets pretty successfully. Mm-hmm. But the number of people who are getting homeless is faster than the number of people who are getting off the streets.
Right.
So for every 10 people you get off the streets, 12 people will get homeless. Mm-hmm. So then it's just increasing. Mm-hmm. So that tells me that one of the things, I mean, there's so much we can do. I mean, I think we could have 3 whole podcasts just on homelessness. But that tells me that one of the things we need to do is do a better job of preventing people from becoming homeless in the first place. Mm-hmm. So we've been trying to look at innovative programs around diversion. We have a pilot program on a shallow rent subsidy for seniors, mm-hmm. To give folks who are strongly at risk of becoming homeless a rent subsidy to be able to stay housed, because it costs much, much less money and is much, much better for everyone if someone can keep a roof over their heads rather than becoming homeless. Mm-hmm. Keep seniors off the streets, because that's our fastest growing homeless population, our seniors. About 25% of our homeless population is now seniors here in San Diego. And so you're trying to figure out how we tackle that, the prevention piece. Also looking at what else can we do around diversion? So people who are not yet homeless, but they come and they've lost their house, but they still, you know, have a car. They're sort of in that mm-hmm. moment of crisis, and they haven't quite settled. They haven't settled into being homeless yet, right? They're like, oh no. Mm-hmm. And right now the backlogs and on the waiting lists are really long to kind of like get into housing, and there's, you know, vouchers. It's just long processes, and sort of having some more quick strategic intervention sort of right there, like at the door, before they even get in the door, but like at the door to kind of get them into housing right away. At the end of the day, you know, cities have to kind of figure out where you're going to have a shelter. You know, counties can't really do that. But what we can do is provide services, mm-hmm. and provide wraparound services. And so we've been partnering with cities. You know, we put out a $10 million grant challenge to all the cities saying, hey, if you guys find a site and a shelter, we'll match it. Mm-hmm. And we'll put money in to have skin in the game, and then we're going to make sure that there's services and wraparound services. And I think we're seeing a lot of progress on that front. Mm-hmm. You know, really kind of across San Diego County is just like step by step city saying, okay, we can do 100 beds here, 50 beds there. I'm definitely pretty happy to see some of the cities beginning to step forward with more safe parking plans. You know, some of these kind of innovative programs around safe camping that I've heard city council members beginning to speak on. And what we can do at the county is say, okay, well, you don't just have to have a campsite. Like, we'll be there. We'll be with the Livewellmobile. We'll be there making sure that people can get, you know, their vaccines, that can get access to healthcare, that can get, you know, sign up for CalFresh and CalWORKs, and, you know, figure out what their benefits are, and can we even get them into job interviews, and can we get them screened by a behavioral health specialist? Can we get them placed in an outpatient services facility? So we're really looking at how to scale up our LiveWell mobiles, mm-hmm. to be able to be present at the homeless shelters that the cities are, I think, doing some work to try to get started. One of the things that I've been looking at is, you know, some of the young people that end up on our street, and like why. Mm-hmm. And we do know that there's a number of people who end up homeless because they get kicked out of their house for coming out as LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. And so we have a new program at the county for the first of its kind to have queer affirming homelessness services.
Oh, wow.
And because that's never happened. And mm-hmm. so you had young people who just felt they had nowhere to go and they were kicked out of their house. And so that's another place that I'm pretty hopeful that we can begin to see some progress.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious at the response to mental health crisis. I know there are some efforts to, you know, not have police officers respond to those calls and having professionals who are maybe more equipped to that. What's the county doing on that front?
Yep. So we started a new program. It was at the under the previous board, they had kind of begun to pilot a little program. And then when Nora and I won in 2020 and joined Nathan on the board, we then launched this region-wide to do a regional program on mobile crisis response. Essentially how it works is individuals who are trained in behavioral health crisis interventions, mm-hmm. They are assembled in a team with different kinds of competencies. So it's called a mobile crisis response team. And they're dispatched instead of armed law enforcement in instances where that's more appropriate, where people actually need help and don't need, you know, police with guns. And, you know, I think there's definitely been a lot of early successes. I'd like to see it expand and do more. But so far, this last year, 3,600 responses to calls. Mm-hmm. And over 1,000 of those were diverted from 911. So I think that's important for people to keep in mind as well, that it's not only that you want to make sure that people get the help that they need and don't maybe get shot because mm-hmm. someone who doesn't understand what's going on shows up and thinks it's a threat when they actually need a crisis or behavioral health specialist. But it also means that our armed law enforcement can actually stay focused on protecting public safety and responding to real threats instead of, you know, spending 10, 12, 15 hours driving someone to central booking and walking them through it. And at the end of the day, you just take them back out again because that mm-hmm. was not the right place for them. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of it. And I think of that as that's the outward facing part of the response is the mobile crisis response teams. I think about 20% of the people who have been served by a mobile crisis response team are self-identify as homeless. Mm-hmm. So we know that these teams are helping people in need on our streets and hopefully often connecting them to some of the services that they need to begin to get off of our streets. So there's a really strong intersection there. The other part of this is just going back to behavioral health, is the investments we're making in crisis stabilization units. We've built 6 so far across mm-hmm. our county.
What are those exactly?
So the crisis stabilization unit means that you go there and you actually get seen and treated and evaluated by a behavioral health specialist mm-hmm. instead of being taken to jail. I mean, just think about you have a person who's having a behavioral health crisis and they were getting taken to jail, mm-hmm. which was completely inappropriate, got no help. They actually often got worse
mm-hmm.
And then ended up back in the streets again. And so our CSUs are really focused at making sure that people, you know, can get stabilized. It's also a place that people can go and get taken or self-check in also, like honestly, mm-hmm. often self-check in way upstream before you might need to be in a psychiatric hospital or in one of the beds that, you know, at our facilities that are supposed to be for people who are really in acute crisis.
And you touched on this earlier about, you know, it's kind of on the cities to identify locations where, you know, they can open up a shelter, maybe safe camping, as there's been some discussions in the city of San Diego, safe parking lots as well. And the county can offer those services that are crucial, right? You don't want to just open up a lot where people can park and
exactly.
not provide any services. And I know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think at first there was some issue getting county or cities to apply for some of those grants and funding that the county was providing. I remember reading that.
It took a little bit longer than we had anticipated, but I think to the city's credit, they were just trying to do their due diligence to make sure that once they applied that they actually would be able to build. Because just to call a spade and be really honest, I mean, we all know that this is a crisis facing our community, but nobody wants a solution in their backyard. Mm-hmm. And so the city, like a lot of our representatives had real work to do to make sure that when they found sites, that they, that the community would be supportive.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get into Care Court.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious where that's at and if you could kind of explain what Care Court is.
Sure. So Care Court is a pilot program, I think is the best way to describe it, mm-hmm. approved by the legislature last cycle, championed by the governor, and San Diego has volunteered to be one of the first counties to try it out to see if we can figure out how to make it work. And basically what it does is it creates specialty courts where if there is an individual who is suffering and dealing with like a behavioral health crisis in particular, ongoing, it could be chronic, it doesn't have to be acute, mm-hmm. But they're not willing to voluntarily seek care, someone else can put a petition into the court and ask that they be evaluated, the individual be evaluated for treatment. Mm-hmm. And then they go in front of the court and they have an advocate. Basically, they get an evaluation by the county behavioral health team, try to assess and try to better understand what's going on. They also get a public defender just to make sure that their own rights are being protected, and go to the court. And the idea is for them to come up with a treatment plan that they weren't willing to seek themselves. And then they will have to adhere to that treatment plan. And the hope is it's less than a year. That's mm-hmm. the idea. And then they would come back to the court. And if they had fulfilled the conditions of their treatment plan and it seemed that they are going in a state, in a place that they're going to continue to adhere to those conditions, mm-hmm. Then they would be released from the supervision of the court. So, if, for example, they were successfully taking their medication that had been prescribed, and the court decided that they were going to continue taking that medication, then they would have been deemed to have graduated. Mm-hmm. But if they don't, or if it's not going well, then they sort of go back into that cycle again and continue to get treatment. You know, I personally have two friends mm-hmm. who have very close family members who have severe behavioral health challenges and are refusing to get treatment. Mm-hmm. And this would create an avenue to allow that treatment to happen. That being said, I think there's a lot of challenges, right? Like, I think we have to be really clear that this is not, you know, it's going to be like a magical solution or something to our homelessness problem, like at all. You know, mm-hmm. I don't even know numerically if it's going to make the dent that people think. So mm-hmm. do you think we have some like expectation management to do on mm-hmm. It being, you know, really helpful in a lot of ways, but probably not going to have the big dramatic impact that I think people might hope. And also we have to be careful that it's not abused, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, there's obviously like a history in this country, but, you know, frankly, like in many countries of women who their husbands didn't like what they were doing, mm-hmm. involuntarily committing them to psychiatric institutions, you know, other ways in which involuntary commitment has been like abused to get elderly people sort of out of the way and mm-hmm. Take their, you know, their finance, take over their finances. I mean, you could just see historically, it's not an imaginary thing, historically, and it's particularly, it has been levied against women by husbands who were, you know, mm-hmm. This was the common thing of a husband wanted, had a mistress, they'd like lock, mm-hmm. want to lock away their wife in the 1800s. So like, we're not going back, right? So we just have to be careful that we're really protecting people's dignity and civil liberties as we also really try to get them the help, the health care that they need.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what capacity is available, or I don't know how that's determined?
This is such a good question. It's actually a meeting I had last week to try to suss this out. We don't know, because mm-hmm. we don't know how many people are going to be referred. Mm-hmm. So our goal is to have capacity to process however many people are referred.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no idea how many people are going to be referred. And of course, there's going to be a review process, right? So if there's a referral – and there's no evidentiary basis that a person has any behavioral health issues, right? And it's just some random person, like, that's not going to the judge. I mean, come on. So that's just harassment. Mm-hmm. So we are clearly going to have a process, but our goal is certainly to be able to meet the demand, and we have no idea what that's going to look like.
Yeah.
So implementation is extremely difficult. I mean, very honestly, it's going to be really hard. Like, we're trying to build a system that we don't have any clue how many users there's going to be.
Mm-hmm. That's scary.
Well, I mean, it's an opportunity. You know, I think it's always good to have another tool in toolbox. But I think people are just so concerned about homelessness for all the right reasons. You know, mm-hmm. it's a really huge challenge that we need to be tackling with everything that we can. But unfortunately, it's so easy to want to look for a magic bullet. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like trying to, you know, solve like education, you know, to solve mm-hmm. education, right? That's not, you don't like pass, you know, some new curriculum mm-hmm. and then we've solved education, right? Like, all of these really intractable problems are hard and mm-hmm. require us to kind of unpack what the root drivers and how do we get at all of these root drivers and be really evidence-based. And look at what works and doesn't work, and when something's not working, get rid of that program and reallocate money to the successful programs. Like, you just got to be iterating and improving all the time. You're not gonna, it's not, you know, no silver bullets.
Is there anything else you wanted to speak to that I didn't ask you?
I think I'm really excited about some really nerdy stuff we're doing. Okay. And so one of those things—
Our wonks love it.
I love it. So I think big picture for me, what's important is that we are learning from setbacks and scaling up successes, that we're not doubling and tripling down on rhetoric and saying, you know, we passed a program, it's working great. Like, no, if something doesn't work, let's get rid of it and mm-hmm. let's do something better. But you can only really make government more impactful and effective if we actually evaluate our programming, mm-hmm. and which we never had been doing, mm-hmm. Which is crazy because we have a $7.3 billion budget and no office that of evaluation. So we now have an office of evaluation and performance analysis, and we have a strategic plan that we're in the process of putting together of all the programs that are going to be evaluated. It clearly can't be all $7.3 billion of them. Mm-hmm. Partnering with a lot of local universities and academics to conduct some of these studies, partnering with community partners to evaluate programs. So this is, I think, a longer-term investment on good governance mm-hmm. in San Diego County. It's not going to be sexy. It's not going to come back this year or next year, but maybe when I'm gone, then 5-10 years from now, someone that will have, but it's important, right? I mean, we're talking about the future of our community and making sure that these resources are being used wisely. Mm-hmm. And so some of the programs that I mentioned today, as well as some others, like the senior shallow rent subsidy, we mm-hmm. also have a basic income program for families at risk of children being put into the foster care system. So we have a couple other programs that we're moving forward that we're doing really robust studies on whether they work and don't work. And that's mm-hmm. super exciting for me because it's just a total mind shift in how we even think about what we're doing, mm-hmm. that we're really want it to actually make a difference. Mm-hmm. So that's my nerdy thing. And I think all my all my academic friends from back when I was a professor think this is a pretty great idea.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego that celebrates its 18th anniversary this week. You can support our 18 years of work and invest in our future by donating at vosd.org/podpeople. The link is in the show notes. I'm Andrea Lopez Villafana, Managing Editor at Voice of San Diego. Scott Lewis is CEO and Editor-in-Chief. Andrew Keats is Managing Editor. Nate John is our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.